Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going?
Exacted by local agents on commission. whose techniques included extortion and loan sharking. Cicero claimed that Brutus lent money to a Cypriot town at an interest rate of 48%, evidently a common practice and an early precedent for third world debt. Whether they were well-born patricians or overnight millionaires, Rome's soldiers of fortune wanted to enjoy and display their winnings at home. The result was a land boom everywhere within range of the capital. Peasants were dispossessed and driven onto unsuitable land, with environmental consequences like those that Solon had recognized in Athens. Family farms couldn't compete against big estates using slave labor. They went bankrupt or were forced to sell out, and their young men joined the legions. The ancient commons of the Roman peasantry were alienated with even less legality. As in Sumer, public land passed quickly into private hands, a situation the Gracchus brothers tried to remedy with land reform in the late 2nd century BC. But the reform failed, the commons were lost, and the state had to placate the lower orders by handing out free wheat, a solution that became increasingly expensive as the urban proletariat increased. By the time of Claudius, 200,000 Roman families were on the dole. One of the revealing ironies of Rome's history is that the city-state's native democracy withered as its empire grew. Real power passed from the Senate into the willing hands of field commanders such as Julius Caesar, who controlled whole armies and provinces. It must be said that in return for power, Caesar gave Rome intelligent reforms, a precedent often invoked by despots impatient with the law. Necessity, wrote Milton, is always the tyrant's plea. Explanations for Rome's fall run the gamut. Plagues, lead poisoning, mad emperors, corruption, barbarians, Christianity. And Joseph Tainter, in his book on social collapses, has added Parkinson's Law. Complex systems, he argues, inevitably succumb to diminishing returns. Even if other things remain equal, the costs of running and defending an empire eventually grow so burdensome that it becomes more efficient to throw off the whole imperial superstructure and revert to local forms of organization. By the time of Constantine, the imperial standing army was more than 500,000 men, an enormous drain on a treasury whose revenue depended mainly on agriculture, especially as many of the biggest landowners had been granted tax exemptions. The government's solution was to debase the currency used for payrolls. Eventually, the denarius, or Roman silver penny, contained so little silver that it became, in effect, paper money. Inflation of Weimar proportions ensued. At the beginning of the 4th century, it took 4,000 silver coins to buy one gold solidus. By the end of that century, it took 180 million. Citizens worn down by inflation and unfair taxation began defecting to the Goths. Because Rome was a literate society, we know of such woes as they affected higher levels of the human pyramid. But beneath the ills of the body politic lay a steady degradation of the natural pyramid that sustained the whole enterprise. Archaeological work in Italy and Spain has revealed severe erosion corresponding to high levels of agricultural activity during imperial times, followed by population collapse and abandonment until the late Middle Ages. As the empire impoverished the soils of southern Europe, Rome exported its environmental load to colonies, becoming dependent on grain from North Africa and the Middle East. The consequences can be seen in those regions today. Antioch, capital of Roman Syria, lies under some 30 feet of silt washed down from deforested hills. And the great Libyan ruins of Leptis Magna now stand in a desert. Rome's ancient breadbaskets are filled with sand and dust. That is not, of course, the whole story. Rome controlled many environments, not all of which were exploited so destructively. Europe north of the Alps, with a wetter climate and heavy soils unsuited to the crude plows of the time, stayed lightly settled. Roman London was only half a square mile, and the spa town of Bath, whose walls impressed an early English poet as a kingly thing, the work of giants, covered only 24 acres. Medieval history confirms the archaeological evidence. The empire fell hardest at its core, the Mediterranean basin, where the brunt of the environmental cost was borne.
Bye.
Some scholars attribute the Maya fall to a severe drought early in the 9th century, a Maya dust bowl. Yet collapse in several areas had already begun by then. During their peak in the 8th century, the great cities of the Maya heartland were running at the limit. They had cashed in all their natural capital. The forest was cut, the fields worn out, the population too high, and the building boom made matters worse, taking more land and timber. Their situation was unstable, vulnerable to any downturn in natural systems. A drought, even if it was no worse than others the Maya had weathered before, would have been more of a finishing blow than a cause. As the crisis gathered, the response of the rulers was not to seek a new course, to cut back on royal and military expenditures, to put effort into land reclamation through terracing, or to encourage birth control, methods of which the Maya may have known. No, they dug in their heels and carried on doing what they had always done, only more so. Their solution was higher pyramids, more power to the kings, harder work for the masses, more foreign wars. In modern terms, the Maya elite became extremists or ultra-conservatives, squeezing the last drops of profit from nature and humanity.
Many of the great ruins that grace the deserts and jungles of the earth are monuments to progress traps, the headstones of civilizations which fell victim to their own success. In the fates of such societies, once mighty, complex, and brilliant, lie instructive lessons for for our own. They're ruins of shipwrecks that mark the shoals of progress. Or, to use a more modern analogy, they are fallen airliners whose black boxes can tell us what went wrong. Despite certain events of the 20th century, most people in the Western cultural tradition still believe in the Victorian ideal of progress, a belief succinctly defined by the historian Sidney Pollard in 1968 as the assumption that a pattern of change exists in the history of mankind, that it consists of irreversible changes in one direction only, and that this direction is towards improvement. Our technological culture measures human progress by technology. The club is better than the fist, the arrow better than the club, the bullet better than the arrow. So we came to this belief for empirical reasons, because it's deliberate. Pollard notes that the idea of material progress is a very recent one, significant only in the past 300 years or so, coinciding with the rise of science and industry and the corresponding decline of traditional beliefs. You see, our idea of progress is very much a Victorian idea. And the idea that the world is a big place and you can just go on exploiting it is very Victorian. And in Victorian times it was true. When Queen Victoria died, there was only a quarter of the population that exists now. And the economic and therefore the environmental impact of that population was only about a 40th or a 50th of what it is now. So we're sort of using up the world 50 times more than the Victorians were, and yet we're still locked into their idea that the world's a big place and you can just do this kind of thing in it. We can't. Myth is an arrangement of the past, whether real or imagined, in patterns that reinforce a culture's deepest values and aspirations. Myths are so fraught with meaning that we live and die by them. They are the maps by which cultures navigate through time.
That the mural goes on and on. That the mural goes on and on. That the mural goes on and on, Clem says. Is what makes it so good. ¶¶
our civilization's particulars differ from previous ones, but not as much as we like to think. All cultures, past and present, are dynamic. Even the most slow-moving were, in the long run, works in progress. While the facts of each case differ, the patterns through time are alarmingly and encouragingly similar. We should be alarmed by the predictability of our mistakes, but encouraged that this very fact makes them useful for understanding what we face today. We often prefer to think of the deep past as innocent and unspoiled, a time of ease and simple plenty. Eden and Paradise feature prominently in popular book titles on anthropology and history. For some, Eden was the pre-agricultural world, the age of hunting and gathering. For others, it was the pre-Columbian world, the Americas before the white man. And for many, it was the pre-industrial world, the long stillness before the machine. Certainly there'd been good and bad times to be alive, but the truth is, the human beings drove themselves out of Eden, and they've done it again and again by fouling their own nest. If we want to live in an earthly paradise, it is up to us to shape it, to share it, and look after it.
Culture, said W.H. Auden, is no better than its woods. Civilizations have developed many techniques for making the earth produce more food, some sustainable, others not. The lesson I read in the past is this, that the health of land and water, and of woods, which are the keepers of water, can be the only lasting basis for any civilization's survival and success. Eventually, from rags of woodland left in buffer zones between the fallen city-states, the Maya jungle grew back. A family squatting in an empty palace at Tikal, as some did in the aftermath, would have seen thorns and saplings reclaiming the old fields, seen the bush edging into the streets, and heard the weary voices of returning wildlife. Reflecting on the slow revival of fertility and its eventual promise, they might have agreed with Kafka. There is hope, though not for us.
Myth is an arrangement of the past, whether real or imagined, in patterns that reinforce a culture's deepest values and aspirations. Myths are so fraught with meaning that we live and die by them. They are the maps by which cultures navigate through time.
Culture is no better than its woods.